Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Well, good morning and welcome to this week's edition of Driven to Business. Driven to Business is a business program where we celebrate success, we learn from failure, and we cover all aspects of business. And we're very glad you're here today. By the way, we are streaming live on biz1190.com, and we will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com. So check us out there. Our guest today is Chuck Wade. Chuck is a CEO of an interesting organization called Drugs Don't Work. Chuck's also a former police officer, and we'll get into that as the program goes along. Chuck, welcome to Driven to Business.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you, sir.
Chuck, you are the CEO of Drugs Don't Work, which is a fascinating name for an organization. tell us about that.
Well, I actually am the state director of the Drugs Don't Work program. I'm the CEO of the Council on Alcohol and Drugs.
The council is the parent corporation
for the Drugs Don't Work program. Okay. The council is a 44-year-old nonprofit drug and alcohol prevention agency headquartered here in Atlanta. We provide drug and alcohol prevention information and education throughout Georgia, and we assist companies here and in other states with implementing and maintaining state-certified drug-free workplace programs. Companies that go through these five simple little steps and become a certified drug-free workplace receive a state-mandated discount on workers' comp insurance. In Georgia, that discount's 7.5%, and that's a substantial bottom-line savings for companies.
That is, in fact, and a lot of people perhaps aren't aware. In our business, Chuck, we send field service people out in the manufacturing plants to work on machinery, and our workers' comp is a significant expense. So that's a 7% discount is a very significant discount in workers' comp, which is one of the major expenses actually of labor-intensive type businesses. Chuck, I don't use drugs, and not to be too blunt about it, but I think people that do are idiots. So why should me, as a business person, why should I care about drug abuse in the country?
Well, actually, Eddie, unfortunately, drug use is really everybody's problem. It's America's most serious public health issue. It crosses all age, gender, economic, social, racial, cultural, and other boundaries. Drug abuse hurts all of us. Why? Because drug addicts commit crime to get the drugs they're addicted to, and crime hurts everyone. Employees who are under the influence of drugs hurt themselves and their coworkers. Drunken stone drivers cause accidents that hurt innocent people. Drug use results in people who need treatment but can't afford it, taxing our already overburdened health care system. Drug use increases emergency room admissions and fatalities. It increases the school dropout rate. You know, drug abuse drains more than $160 billion a year from our economy, and $100 billion of that is from American businesses through things like decreased productivity, increased absenteeism and tardiness, less safe workplaces, increased health care costs and workers' comp claim, and more theft and other forms of crime in the workplace. Actually, the total cost to society for alcohol and drug abuse combined is estimated to be about $285 billion every year.
That's a huge number. In fact, it's hard to get your arms and perhaps mind around a number like that. Chuck, prior to going to work for these organizations, you were actually a narcotics officer. So you've seen the more seedy side of the drug abuse issue. Talk to us about that a little bit. What's it like being a narcotics officer, particularly, and tell us how you transitioned from that into what you're doing now.
Well, I very much enjoyed my time working as a narcotics agent. You know, for 11 years, I worked undercover, and I lived with drug users and dealers and drug addicts. From that experience, I learned some things about the drug problem in America. The first thing I learned is just how serious the drug problem is. I think it's the most serious problem facing us as a nation. I'm convinced that drugs are a contagious terminal plague on America, Eddie, and I'm afraid if we don't get serious now and do something about America's drug problem, I'm really afraid that our country is going to end up like the Roman Empire. I'm sure you remember reading about the Roman Empire in your history book back in high school. I know that you'll remember that the Roman Empire was a world power, and the people who lived in the Roman Empire suffered from the same thing that we as Americans suffer from. It's called ethnocentricity. It means that they, just like us, thought that they were the greatest race of people on the earth and their country would be there forever. Where's the Roman Empire? It's gone. It stood for almost 500 years, and then it crumbled. And it was destroyed not by some foreign power that invaded. It was destroyed from within by the people that lived in that country. And as one of your frontline soldiers out there fighting that war on drugs for you for 11 years, I promise you, history is indeed repeating itself. America is a 237-year-old world power that is not going to survive to 500 years if we don't do something to stop this drug problem. That really is just how bad it is. So after spending 15 years in law enforcement, 11 of those years spent working undercover, attacking the supply side of America's drug problem, I finally woke up and realized that, you know, we're never going to be able to stop drugs from coming into America. We're never going to really be able to make much of a difference attacking the supply side. You know, interdiction and incarceration just really aren't the solution to the drug problem in America. So I transitioned from that to attacking the demand side of America's drug problem through the workplace, and have realized some success over the years in attacking the problem in that way.
You know, that's one of the questions I was going to ask you. You've already answered here. And you know, what you're describing is actually very frustrating for even someone that's not particularly involved with that program looking in, because it seems like in some ways this entire operation, this entire money and time that we spend, and I'm always reading, I used to read about they had interdicted some large drug shipment and you'd go, yay. But now I have to tell you, I'm cynical about that. I'll see, well, we just stop this large shipment of marijuana, and it's like, well, there's more coming. It's like it doesn't make any difference. And I would think that as a police officer particularly, that was very frustrating for you.
It was. It, you know, it only takes 10 tractor trailer loads of cocaine to supply the United States with all the coke it needs for 1 year. So imagine trying to figure out which trucks are bringing in the coke at what point and stopping them. It's impossible. It can't be done. It only takes one airplane the size of a Boeing 747 airplane loaded with heroin, pure heroin, to supply the United States with all the heroin it needs for 1 year. So imagine trying to figure out which large airplane or which smaller planes are smuggling in the heroin at what point. That, too, is impossible. It only takes one 25-square-mile tract of land to grow enough opium poppies or enough coca plants to produce enough heroin or enough cocaine to supply this country with all those drugs it needs for 1 year. So you see, it doesn't matter how many coca fields we destroy over in source countries like Colombia and Peru. It doesn't matter how many opium poppies we eradicate over in source countries in the Middle East like Afghanistan and other Middle Eastern countries. They've already warehoused up enough processed heroin and processed cocaine to supply this country with all those drugs for the next 20 years.
That's a startling, and that's an interesting thing. 10 tractor trailer loads is all it takes for a year. And you're right. I mean, it'd be hard to stop 10 tractor trailer loads of anything.
That's right. Trying to figure out, you know, which trucks are hauling whatever it is into the country is impossible.
Exactly. So, you know, we have jails, Chuck, that are full. We have prisons that are full of people convicted of one or the other drug offense. And you hear horror stories, kind of, in a way, of maybe in three strikes you're out type of laws, so forth, where some minor marijuana guy in some state is sentenced to a very long prison sentence. But you know, again, to stay with the law enforcement side of it just for a moment here, isn't it, I mean, once you put these people in jail, what have you done? I mean, obviously they're not on the street now, but at some point they're going to be.
That's true. Now, I said that incarceration doesn't work, and that's absolutely true. Incarceration alone is not the solution to the drug problem, just like interdiction alone is not the solution to the drug problem. But legalizing drugs and taking away that threat of incarceration is a huge mistake. But
I was going to ask you about that, because that's obviously where the argument can go from there, isn't it?
It is. But let me just say this, Eddie. Regardless of what marijuana legalizers would tell you, there are not jackbooted police officers kicking in the dorm room doors of college students and dragging them off, kicking and screaming to jail for smoking a joint. It's just not happening. I was in law enforcement for a long time, and I can tell you this. There's no self-respecting police officer who wants to make a kiddie arrest. There's no cop out there that goes on duty just praying that he's going to stop some kid with a marijuana joint so he can drag him off to jail. That's not what happens. When cops stop kids with pot, you know what they do? If they got a quarter bag of pot, you know what the cop does? He dumps it out on the ground. He crushes it into the ground under his heel. He calls the kid's parents, and that's it. Kids aren't going to jail, you know, by the thousands for smoking a joint. It's just not happening. That's what the marijuana legalizers would like for us to believe, but that's just not the case. But I will say, even though incarceration is not the solution, I will agree with that, we have to have that threat of incarceration, because if you have the option of locking up a drug addict, that works. Why? Because too often the threat of incarceration is the only way to force a drug addict to get the help they so badly need. Because, you see, denial is a serious part of the disease of addiction. Drug addicts never believe that they have a problem, so they have no reason to seek treatment. But when that addict gets arrested for using or for dealing drugs, a drug court can force that addict into treatment. And the scientific community has put these drug courts under a microscope, and they've concluded that drug courts work, because nationwide, 75% of drug court graduates remain arrest-free at least 2 years after leaving the program. And there have been all these rigorous studies examining the long-term outcomes of individual drug courts, and they found that reductions in crime last at least 3 years and can endure for over 14 years. And there's been all these rigorous, conservative, scientific meta-analysis of drug courts, and they've all concluded that drug courts have significantly reduced crime as much as 45%. But another reason that we need to have that option of arresting people for using drugs is that addiction is a chronic, progressive disease of the brain. It gets worse and worse. And unless something happens to break the cycle of addiction, a drug addict will always progress from stage one through stage four addiction. And it's the stage four drug addicts and alcoholics who can't hold a job, they can't function in society, they lay in the gutter with puke all over them. So if an addict refuses to get help and insist on continuing in their addiction, eventually that person is going to hurt others by their actions, they're going to resort to crime to feed their addiction, and they're going to become a burden on society because of their health issues that they can't afford to have treated, and we all end up paying for that. So we have to have the option of incarceration. We can't just give up, throw in the towel, and legalize drugs. That would be the biggest mistake we could ever make.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because, I mean, as you know, the other side, the people that push that do make a persuasive argument. And everyone that pushes that is not a drug user or trying to make money out of drugs. A lot of people are just really frustrated with what they see in terms of a so-called war on drugs, and they think, okay, to heck with it. If this is what these people want to do, I think they're dumb, but let them. I mean, you know, just quit spending my money to mess with them. But as you've pointed out, if you do that, that problem doesn't just lie stagnant where it is. It's going to it will tend to grow, and we'll be facing an even bigger problem. I think, as you know, the argument for less criminalization, it has to do with with the fact that it lowers it supposedly would lower the cost of the money. And after the break, I want to read you an economics professor at a Baptist college, of all things, was saying about that. He took the unusual position of pushing for legalization. And we'll be back after the break to talk about that. You are listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're glad you're here. We have Chuck Wade with us talking about drugs and more to come. So stick around. He was a hard-headed man. He was brutally handsome. She was terminally pretty. She held him up and he held up. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. We're glad you're here. We're talking with Chuck Wade, and we're talking about drugs, which may sound like a very funny thing for a business program to be talking about, but as Chuck has already told us, we're not immune from that. Chuck, to give you a little bit of a personal take on this, I was not raised around drugs at all, and I am admittedly completely naive about drugs. I honestly would not recognize marijuana if I saw it. I'll tell you a quick story about this. I was in California a number of years ago going to a business meeting, and I forgot my tie. And it was back when the days when we all wore ties to business meetings. And I had a green suit, and I needed a tie. So I just walked into a men's store there and bought what looked like a tie that kind of matched my shirt and suit. And it was a Grateful Dead tie. I thought, no problem. So it was really good looking tie, nice green tie with a good pattern on it. Well, I got back, and I came back home. I wore it to church and several other places. And then one of my daughters said, "Dad, you know what that tie is?" And I said, "No." He said, "That's a close up of a marijuana plant." And here I am wearing it to business meetings at a church, knowing nothing about it. But you know, one of the things that I have found out, to my dismay, over the years of dealing with employees, is that when you have an otherwise good employee that begins exhibiting inexplicable behavior, like just inexplicable absences, and the and their excuses just don't make any sense for the absence, or strange behavior at work that suddenly you can't quit. Like, why in the world would you do that? And the guy will, and he'll give you some answer that doesn't make any sense about it. What we've learned over time is that in my case, Chuck, 100% of the time, it's been an addiction problem, either to alcohol or to some other drugs or to a combination of all. And I don't think my experience is unique in that area.
Sure, that happens all the time. You know, when you have an employee that's exhibiting those kinds of problems, what you should do, of course, is just document that unacceptable work performance. And the goal should be to try and recover that good employee. You know, after you document that unacceptable work performance, you should do a reasonable suspicion drug test. Then the goal should be to get that employee into treatment and get them well and get them back to work and get them productive again. One of the reasons that drug-free workplace programs work so well is because if you have an employee, a problem employee, or someone who's developed a problem with drug use or alcohol abuse, and you do a reasonable suspicion drug test and identify that as the issue, if you tell that employee, "Look, you've tested positive for drugs, but if you'll do what I ask you to do and you go into this treatment program, which we're providing through the workplace here, either through our health insurance or we'll give you a list of treatment and counseling centers where you can go get some help. If you'll go into that treatment, if you'll go get that counseling and get well, you can keep your good job." Quite often, many times, that is enough of an incentive to get that employee to take that very difficult and most important first step and go into the counseling. Then once they return to work, after they've completed the counseling, once they return to work, you test them periodically. That's part of the drug-free workplace program. And in testing them, that's a hammer that hangs over their head that could fall at any minute that helps them to keep from relapsing, because denial is a very serious problem of the disease of addiction, and relapse is a very serious problem of the disease of addiction. So through a drug for workplace program, you can break through the denial with the results of a positive drug test. You can give that person a reason to get well. You can keep your good job. You can make treatment available to them that they otherwise could not afford. And then once they return to work from treatment, you can do the continued drug testing as a reason to stay well, to not relapse. So there's really no other program out there that has all of those elements. And when someone's addicted, you've got to have all of those elements present. You've got to break through the denial. You've got to give them a reason to get well. You've got to make the treatment available to them, and you got to give them a reason to not relapse.
In my experience, being around just some other friends and friends' children and family members even, that have had addiction problems, it seems to me that getting through that wall of denial is a hard thing to do, because it seems like they, no matter what you're showing them, they just say, "No, I don't really have a problem with this, just because I, you know, was too drunk to come to work Monday, that doesn't mean I really have a problem with it. I can stop this anytime." But you know, it's continued and they can't. I guess this is an obvious answer, but how do you get in somebody's face and say, "Look, this is just not acceptable"?
You know, as I said earlier, and as you just said, the problem is denial. You know, denial is a very serious problem of the disease of addiction. The disease structures itself in such a way that the disease protects itself through the denial. And the denial tells that drug addict or that alcoholic that they don't have a problem. You know, the denial tells that drug addict or that alcoholic, you know, "You don't have a problem. It's everyone else. It's all these other sticks in the mud that just don't know how to party." So it's very difficult to break through that denial. You've got to have a way to do that. And whether it's in the workplace, a positive drug test in the workplace, or whether it's a parent who randomly drug tests their child out of love for that child, to give that child a reason to be able, first of all, to say no to the drug use, so that when that peer pressure comes, that intense peer pressure, which will come, and their friends are saying, "Here, smoke this joint, or drop this hit of acid, or snort this line of coke," or whatever, the child can say, "You know what, I would love to, I'm as cool as anybody else. I would absolutely love to get high with you guys, but I can't because my parents are Nazis and they drug test me. So that's very important. In the workplace, the threat of the drug test helps employees to get and remain drug free. And if parents would just have the guts to be a parent and out of love, drug test their children to take that peer pressure off of them, give that kid a reason to say no. You know, think about that, Eddie. If you got a kid, if you got a teenager who wants to go to a party, but you're worried that there might be drinking or drugs there, if you test that child, if you drug test them and they know it, they've agreed to it, they've signed a family contract where they've agreed to being drug tested, and they know that if they fail a drug test, they're going to lose all their privileges. If you've got that in place and the kid says, I want to go to a party, say, sure, absolutely, go. Have a great time. Enjoy yourself. I want you to have a great time. But know that when you come home, as soon as your foot crosses the threshold, we're going to drug and alcohol test you. Not because we don't trust you, but because we love you, because we want to protect you, because we want to make sure that you don't end up ruining your life, you know, because you're making a decision before your adolescent brain is fully formed to where it can make a decision, because you know the brain doesn't form until we're in our mid-20s, doesn't fully form. So there has to be guardrails in place, and parents have to put those guardrails in place. So I think the best way to do that, to break through that denial, is through the results of a positive drug test.
That's an astonishing. I have to tell you, Chuck, I've never heard a parent do that. That sounds like it isn't very. It's a fascinating. We've often talked to parents. You know, when my kids, when the internet came into play and my kids were at home, we moved our computer from a private room into a very public room. And I told in front of my kids too, it's my internet use is public here also. It's a check on me. Mm-hmm. It's a check on you. You never know when your mom and I are going to come walking in. Whatever your website you're on, we could be walking behind you. Same, but you can come walking in behind me. And there, once you sort of put it that way, everybody kind of buys into it.
Right. It's accountability. Eddie, there's nothing in the world wrong with accountability. Not a thing in the world wrong with it. You know, accountability shows and proves that you love someone if you hold them accountable, you know, especially children. The problem is parents just don't want to do that these days. They just want to be the kid's best friend. They just want to be the cool parent, you know. They don't want to do what they need to do. We've been drug testing our boys since they were 12 years old. Dylan's 19 now. He's a police officer. He's the youngest sworn law enforcement officer in the state, works for the Department of Revenue as an undercover investigator. And Austin's about to go in the military, into the Marines. He's 17 now. They're both drug and alcohol free. We've been randomly drug and alcohol testing them since they were 12 years old. Now, we don't make them pee in a cup because the American Pediatric Association says that can hurt a relationship between a parent and a child. We use oral fluid tests. It's a plastic stick with a sponge on the end of it that they hold in their mouth for 2 minutes. It's not invasive. It doesn't hurt them. And what we told them is this: look, you're going to get that peer pressure. We don't want you to have to deal with that. I'm going to take it for you. I'm man enough, son. I'll take that peer pressure for you. You just tell those kids that you can't get high because, you know, dad drug test you. And that happened to Dylan. It happened to Dylan in middle school. He was offered marijuana, and he said, I can't. My parents drug test me. From that point on, all the way through middle school and high school, he went to school with the same kids. They all said the same thing. Look, Dylan's cool. Don't ask him to get high. He can't. Don't put him in that position. He's a good guy. You know, his dad's a jerk. And, hey, you know what? They can call me a jerk all they want. I couldn't care less.
Yeah, I felt the same way when my kids are at home. We have adult children now, and I'm good friends with them. But my wife and I both said that our job as parents was not to be our children's friends. You can be their friends, but they're going to have plenty of friends. But they've only got, you know, us as a parents, and we've got to do our job. After the break, I want to talk to you a little bit more about the idea of an employee, and I'll just give you a little preview of it. You know, in our company, we are required to sign off that we're a drug-free workplace and to assure that we don't. And we send our employees into dangerous machinery, high voltage, things of that sort. And so the liabilities of sending someone out there that might be potentially using drugs is very high.
Sure.
So what I want to ask you about after the break is, the treatment thing is fine, but we cannot take the risk that a guy is going to be out there high on drugs because the results of that could be somebody getting killed, either them or someone else. So
that's,
I want to talk to you about that when we get back from the break. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Once again, let me remind you that we are streaming live on biz1190.com. and podcast on eddiemayfield.com. We're here every Saturday on Biz 1190 AM WAFS. Talking with Chuck Wade. Back in just a moment.
He was a hard-headed man. He was brutally handsome. She was terminally pretty.
Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're here every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. on WAFS Biz 1190, Atlanta's Business Radio. And we're glad you're here. We are talking with Chuck Wade. Chuck is the Executive Director and CEO of the Council on Alcohol and Drugs, and he's the State Director of a subset of that organization called Drugs Don't Work. Chuck, we're glad you're here. Chuck, before the break, I was talking to you about the idea that perhaps there are times we're just going to have to not have an employee that's got a drug problem. I mean, what's your take on that? I mean, I know a lot of people just terminate employees they find with drug problems.
Right. A lot of companies have what's called a zero tolerance policy, and if an employee tests positive for drugs, that's it. End of story. You're gone. No second chances. And in some industries, that's absolutely necessary. You have to have a zero tolerance policy. But what we recommend, when possible, is to not have a zero tolerance policy, but to have your policy say that a positive drug test will result in up to and including termination. Up to and including termination means you can make a decision on a case-by-case basis on whether to fire the employee or to allow them to go to treatment. And we say, if it's possible, always, always allow the employee to go to treatment and try to help them and encourage them to get well.
Well, I think, you know, most business people like me, there is a side of you that feels sorry
sure.
for these people. I mean, no one wants to see anyone ruin their lives. And particularly if it's a talented person, you can say, you know, you have a lot of talent. What in the world? Are you just kind of flushing your life down the toilet here? And they did not, a lot of them did not have particularly supportive parents or a family, and they've done pretty well despite that, but yet they've fallen off the wagon in this area, and you do feel sorry for them. But at the same token, like you said, there are just times when you can't tolerate it because you have agreed to your customers that you're not sending employees into that situation to endanger them and their employees.
That's right. You know, there's legal liability. If you have reason to believe an employee's using drugs and you don't take action to correct that problem,
right.
you could be sued and you could be found guilty of negligent retention if that employee ends up hurting himself or a coworker. So while typically under most state workers' comp laws, an employer or supervisor is generally immune from lawsuits when an employee suffers injuries like in a work-related accident. And that immunity, as I said, extends to supervisors. But there have been cases where employees have sued supervisors personally for physical or emotional pain and suffering caused by workplace injury, and they've won. So a supervisor can lose that legal immunity from being sued if he commits a negligent act, you know, that's outside the scope of the company's responsibility to provide a safe workplace, for example.
Exactly.
So, like, an employee might be able to show that a supervisor was clearly negligent when, after being informed of a workplace hazard, such as drug or alcohol use by a worker, a coworker, under his supervision, he ignored that problem and failed to take any corrective action because it's been proven that alcohol and drug abuse present a recognized occupational hazard that's likely to cause death or serious physical harm. So theoretically, a supervisor could be deemed by a court as acting outside his or her duties when, after being informed of an employee's drug or alcohol abuse or becoming aware of it, for example, through a reasonable suspicion drug test, if they fail to follow up and investigate that complaint further or take action, if you make an employee or you send a drug-using employee onto a work site where other employees have to work alongside that substance abuser, that can be ruled an act of negligence that might cause supervisors to lose immunity from liability and be sued. But the bottom line is, Eddie, this is simple truth. One drug-using employee can destroy a company from within. I've seen that happen.
Right.
One drug-using employee can put a company on its knees. Why? Because drug use is contagious. It spreads through the workplace.
And for those of you listening that either manage or own businesses, you need to take that to heart. You know, you have some options when you find you have an employee that's addicted to drugs or alcohol. There are several options you have. One of your options, however, is not to ignore it. That's not an option. That's going to lead to disaster.
Right.
You know, this is a bit off the subject here, Chuck. I went to Europe here not too long ago, and more recently even to Russia. And when I was in Europe, we were visiting I forgot the name of the castle, but it's a castle that the Disney Magic Kingdom is patterned after. It's in Austria. And it was built by a guy they call Mad King Ludwig, and supposedly an insane king. Well, I read his biography, and one thing that struck out to me, he drank a prodigious amount of rum every day. And my wife and I read that biography, and I was thinking, he wasn't mad. He was drunk. I mean, the guy was alcohol addicted. That's exactly why he did it. I just finished reading a biography on Stalin. And one of the things the biographer talked about was how much alcohol Stalin consumed every day. And I think we overlook that even in history, some of the horrors that take place by people that even in positions of extreme leadership, like Stalin, for instance, and what may have prompted him to do some of the things he did, the fact that he was inebriated most of the time.
That's very possible. You know, I hear this a lot. You know, they say, well, look at all these famous, successful people who, you know, use drugs, and they're fine. You know, our own president admitted to drug use, you know. We've had a couple of presidents who've admitted to drug use. You know, we've had Olympic athletes, you know, gold medal winners who've admitted to drug use in their past. What I always say is, gosh, what could that person accomplish? What could they have accomplished if it hadn't been for their drug use? You know, how did it really impact them? You know, they could have done so much more, but whether they could or not, those people are exceptional. Those people are rare, you know, that achieve any level of success in spite of their drug use or their alcoholism. The typical average person who becomes a drug addict or an alcoholic is not able to accomplish anything near what those exceptional individuals accomplish. You know, the majority of the time, drug addiction, alcoholism just completely ruins people's lives.
You know, there's another thing that I noticed on your website, and by the way, a link to Chuck's website will be on eddiemayfield.com. You can go there, and we have several links to Chuck and his organization on there, so you're welcome to go there and check that out. But you know, one of the things that that I really didn't know until recently is that the potency of marijuana that's grown now is very different than what the hippies were smoking back in the early 60s, isn't it?
That's absolutely true. You know, that backyard dope that you might have smoked when you were back in high school or college, that's 3% THC. THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, that's the active ingredient in marijuana that makes you high. So even just 10 years ago, you know, the best we could produce domestically, the best we could grow here on U.S. soil was about 3% THC. It's up to 20% now.
Wow.
So the marijuana of today, that is not.
That's like the difference. That's like a difference in a glass of wine and a bottle of Jack Daniels or something. I mean, that's a huge difference.
It's even more than that, actually. Right. And with all the legalization of marijuana that's occurring, you know, and because of American ingenuity, we're just getting that THC level higher and higher.
Well, back to the business. For those, just some advice for those of us in business for a moment. You know, let's Chuck. Suppose I have an employee that smokes pot on the weekends, but shows no other signs of he's never absent. He's you know, always seemed to be very sober. And what do I do about that?
Well, I think what you're probably getting at there, Eddie, is, you know, if he's smoking pot on the weekends, what's wrong with that? You know, why shouldn't he be allowed to do that? You know, there are privacy issues here. And I would agree with that. I would say, though, that while it's true that an employee's right to privacy would be violated if personal information that was irrelevant to, you know, their employment was collected or used by a company, that would be an invasion of privacy. But drug testing is relevant to work performance because drug use and alcohol abuse have a negative effect on employee performance.
Right.
Because we mentioned drug use impairs efficiency and results in a less safe workplace. So drug-using employees have more than double the rate of absenteeism, higher turnover rates, higher medical costs than their non-drug-using coworkers. And you know what? Employers have a right to a safe, productive, drug-free workplace. And it's unfair for an employer to have to pay full wages to a drug-impaired employee and unfair for coworkers to have to be subjected to an unsafe environment. And the truth is, what an employee does on the weekend does affect their work performance. But look, I know some people don't want to be drug tested. I get that. You know, sometimes when we implement a drug-free workplace program in a company, we'll have a handful of employees who will whine and cry and moan and groan, and they'll say things like this. They'll say, oh, nay, you're not going to drug test me. That's an invasion of my privacy, or that's a violation of my civil rights. And I always have to ask them this question. What document have you been reading? Because it's certainly not the Constitution of the United States of America, nor its Bill of Rights, because, you see, nowhere in there does it give you a right to use illegal drugs. And the last time I checked, illegal drugs were still illegal. So
right.
Nobody has a right to get high, even in their own home.
Exactly. Hey, to go back a moment with something I mentioned earlier, there was an article in Forbes magazine last year written by a guy named Art Carden, who is a professor, an accounting professor at Samford University over in Alabama, which is a Baptist college. And I don't know Mr. Carden at all, but being as he's teaching in a Baptist college, I sort of doubt he's a drug user. I just sort of doubt that would be allowed. But he's an economics professor, and he makes an economic argument that I know you've heard before, and I'm just going to go ahead and tell you we're probably going to have to run this past the break here before we get into it. I want to give you a quote. He quotes in his article out of an economics book called Modern Principles of Economics, written by two men named Cowan and Tabarrok. And here's what he says. The more effective prohibition is at raising costs, the greater our drug industry revenues. So more effective prohibition means that drug sellers have more money to buy guns, pay bribes, fund the dealers, and even research and develop new technologies in drug delivery, like crack cocaine. It's hard to beat an enemy. They get stronger the more you attack him or her. And his point of this is that the drug war is costing us more than we're getting out of it. Now, you've got about 1 minute to get the break. We can respond after the break. Would you respond to that?
Yes, I'm familiar with that article, and he does make some very good points in there. And what he's saying is that prohibition actually results in more crime, and that if we want less crime, we need to do away with prohibition. But here's the situation. Less crime is good, absolutely, but more addicts is bad. Right. Legalizing drugs would not do away with drug-related crime anyway, because, strangely, drug addicts don't make good employees, and if they can't hold a job, they'll steal to eat, to buy clothes, to pay their rent and their car payments. Or I suppose we could support them on welfare, if anybody thinks that's a good idea. But as far as, like, black market crime goes, unless you give away drugs for free, Eddie, there will always be a black market, and there will always be black market crime. The drug cartels are not going to give up their turf to legal retailers or the government. All they will do is undercut the retailers and the government's price and sell untaxed drugs, and we'll be right back where we started, but with even more drug addicts.
I think that I agree with you, and I'm very glad to hear you make that point, because that's a very – what Professor Carden makes there, and this is not an attack on him, he makes a very persuasive argument there. He really does, and I think he makes it in good faith. I'll give him that. I think it's a good faith argument, because he probably, like a lot of us, just gets sort of disheartened at what we see as continued failures in the drug industry. We'll be back in a few moments and continue – talking with Chuck about this issue. And Chuck, when we come back, I want to talk to you about the primary drug of use in the United States, which is alcohol. Let's talk about that a little bit. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. We're glad you're here. Stick around. We'll do it. Welcome back to the final segment of today's Driven to Business. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. We're here with Chuck Wade, the Executive Director and CEO of the Council on Alcohol and Drugs, State Director, the Georgia State Director of Drugs Don't Work. It's been an interesting and fast-paced show, Chuck. We were talking, you and I were talking during the break, and I was telling you, expressing some of my own frustration, perhaps even mirrored a bit here by the article we were talking about with Professor Carden here, where that we see this these resources and incredible resources and law enforcement time and invasion of privacy and everything else in the name of a drug war that many of us just have decided we've lost. How do you respond to that?
Well, Eddie, listen, I'm the first to say that we haven't won the war on drugs yet, but we haven't lost it either. In the last 30 years, we've reduced drug use across the board in America by 32%.
That's one of the questions I was going to ask you. I'm glad you said that. Yeah.
That's 7.4 million fewer drug users. Listen to this. In the last 25 years, positive drug tests in the workplace have been reduced by 74%.
Wow.
So we're making headway. And the biggest mistake we could ever make right now would be to stop, just give up, and throw in the towel and legalize drugs, because America has never been a country of quitters. We didn't become the strongest nation on earth by quitting. We can't just give up and legalize drugs because the battle's a little bit difficult. What we do need to do, however, is to begin fighting this so-called war on drugs in a different way. What we have to do is stop focusing so much on attacking the supply side of the drug problem. We must begin attacking the demand side of America's drug problem. Because, you see, the drug problem always has been and always will be simple economics. It's supply and demand. So if we're not happy with the way attacking the supply side is working, let's simply reallocate some of those billions of dollars being spent attacking the supply side, and let's use that money to attack the demand side of America's drug problem through drug prevention, which means stopping it before it ever starts, drug treatment, that means getting those well who are already addicted, and drug education. That's the solution to the drug problem.
Let's talk. I'm glad you said that. I agree with that 100%. It you know, the demand side of it is absolutely where the problem is. You know, and even the Mexican government and others, and the Colombian government in the past have complained about, you know, when we're on them about the drug problems, and they can say, you know, they're all being bought by people in the United States. So you can't totally blame us. You know, that's who's buying this.
And they're absolutely right. You know what? America's only 4% of the world's population, yet we consume 66% of all the illegal drugs produced worldwide. That's a problem, and that's our problem. It's because of the way we raise our children. We all raise our children predisposed to drug addictions because of the culture of America. We've got to change that. We've got to change the way we attack the drug problem and begin attacking that demand side.
Just don't spend much time on this, but I do want to talk to you just a moment about where alcohol fits into this, because, you know, alcohol is generally, is generally legal. It's illegal for certain age groups, but by and large, alcohol is legal. So doesn't that raise an issue?
Well, it does, and you're right. Alcohol is a drug. Alcohol kills more kids every year than all the illegal drugs combined. Why? Because it's legal, so it's easily accessible. We have an enormous underage drinking problem in America. Also, excessive drinking by employees in the workplace costs businesses and industries worldwide billions of dollars every year in absenteeism and lost productivity. Alcoholism alone causes more than 500 million lost work days annually. But you know what? It's not even the heavy drinkers, the alcoholics, who are most responsible for that. It's the light to moderate drinkers who cause the most problems. More than half of all alcohol-related problems in the workplace are caused by light drinkers, and 87% by light to moderate drinkers.
But, you know, my personal experience in our family, I have seen a lot more, and even, of course, I'm old enough to have done this, I've seen a lot more problems with alcohol inside families than I have with drugs. And I think that's probably true of a lot of Americans.
It is true. As I said, alcohol's a drug. You know, it causes very serious problems in families and in the workplace. It creates some pretty significant safety and health issues for Americans and American businesses.
Well, Chuck, in the time we have left here, let's spend a good time with. Let's get you to tell us about this. Those of us that run, own, and operate businesses, none of us want a drug-riddled workplace, an unsafe workplace for our employees, for us, for anything else. So, what do we do? How do we deal with that?
Well, becoming a state-certified drug-free workplace is the best thing a company can do, and it's so simple. It's five simple steps. Step one, you have to have a substance abuse policy in place. Every company needs that. We've got a sample policy. I'll send it out to any company absolutely free. It takes about 6 or 8 minutes to go through and create that policy for your company, hand it out to your employees. You're done with step one. Step two, you need to conduct drug testing. Every company needs to be drug testing their employees. Otherwise, you might inadvertently hire a drug-using employee, and that can destroy your company. Step three, you have to provide drug education every year to every one of your employees. That's extremely important. I mentioned the key to the solution of the drug problem is drug prevention, drug treatment, and drug education. We've got to educate the general public to a point where they understand that we've got to reallocate those billions of dollars we're wasting attacks attacking the supply side of the drug problem and begin attacking the demand side. The best way to get that drug education is to employees through the workplace where you've got that captive audience. So that's an important part of the certification process. Step four, you have to provide supervisor training on how to supervise a state-certified drug-free workplace. That training can be done through an in-person presentation, a free DVD I can send you, or through monthly training newsletters. And then the fifth and final step, you have to either have an employee assistance program, which is counseling available for employees who test positive for drugs, or simply a list of treatment and counseling centers available in your area that you can give to employees so they know where to go get some help. 68 of the 130 local chambers of commerce in Georgia offer the Drugs Don't Work program. So if a company is a member of its local chamber of commerce, in most cases they're going to be able to get the assistance they need in getting certified through their local chamber as part of their membership.
Can people come to your website, Chuck, and find out information about this?
Absolutely. If a company is in an area of the state where the local chamber does not offer the Drugs Don't Work program, they can go to our website. That's www.livedrugfree.org. Livedrugfree.org. Just click on Drug Free Workplace, and you can click to read the five steps that I just went over, and they're explained there in details.
Chuck, we have a couple of minutes left here. You've had an interesting career. Starting with being a law enforcement officer, much of it centered around dealing with drug abuse. I'm curious, how did you get into that to start with? Like when you were a police officer, did you decide to go and become a narcotics officer?
Well, actually, it's kind of a funny story, but when I was growing up, I used to enjoy watching a TV show called Starsky and Hutch. I don't know if you remember that,
but
a couple of undercover cops, you know, they drove a pretty cool car. They got into some pretty interesting situations, and so that's what first got me interested in law enforcement in general and specifically in working undercover, and I kind of made a promise to myself then that when I grew up, I was going to do that. But the main reason I did it, Eddie, honestly, is because I know that there are people, innocent people, who need to be protected. And I just felt like, you know, I wanted to be someone who tried to help protect the innocent, you know, like our children, for example. I mentioned earlier, the human brain doesn't develop until the mid-20s, so kids can't even make good decisions about whether or not to use drugs or alcohol until after their brains mature. And in the meantime, there has to be people who will protect those kids from predators who want to make money off of them by getting them addicted to drugs or alcohol. So I decided, you know, pretty early in life that I wanted to be one of those people that protect the innocent. That's why I became a cop, and that's why I do what I do today, because There's a lot of people out there who just want to be able to get high legally or to be able to make a ton of money selling pot or other drugs, and they don't care about kids. They only care about themselves. We need more adults who are willing to stand up against drug legalizers and all their propaganda. We need more people who are willing to spend more than just a few minutes listening to a media soundbite about drug legalization. We need for parents and politicians to do the research on the harm of legalization and take a stand against it.
Well, I hope for those of us, those listening today that run, operate, or own businesses, but based on what Chuck has told us today, perhaps you've been thinking about this yourself, that you take a couple of steps. Number one, don't ignore the problem in your own workplace. You're not immune from it. I've learned that the hard way, as have a lot of other companies. And the second thing is don't ignore those problems. But I think the third thing, and Chuck, is what you've kind of helped us do today, I think, is that don't feel too impotent about that. The problems are big, but they're not something you can't do anything about. You can go to livedrugfree.org or to your local chamber and begin a policy and at least make a small difference in your company. And you know, as you're helping someone in your company, you're also helping their families and your coworkers and your business in general. Chuck, thanks so much for being with us today. It's great having you as a guest.
My pleasure, Eddie. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're welcome. It's a great program, and best of luck to you and your mission and work. You're doing a great job, and I appreciate all that you do. You are listening to Driven to Business. We're going to be here next Saturday at 11 o'clock right here on Biz 1190 WAFS AM. My name is Eddie Mayfield. We check us out on eddiemayfield.com. You'll find a podcast of this program and links to Chuck's website. See you next week.
You've been listening to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Visit next Saturday at 11 a.m. on Biz 1190 for more Driven to Business. To learn more about Driven to Business, visit eddiemayfield.com or call 770-448-4644.